On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Today, we begin a series of weekly profiles of candidates for mayor of Baltimore City. Every Wednesday for the next several weeks, we'll talk to the people who want to lead the city at a time when we face tremendous challenges. This morning, a discussion with Elizabeth Embry, who had this to say when she announced her candidacy in November.
I love Baltimore, and I've devoted my entire career to Baltimore City, to government and to state government, working on problems that Baltimore City faces. And so there's nothing to me more noble or more important than working for the city.
Elizabeth Embry joins me to talk about her vision for Baltimore. Plus, the 436th session of the Maryland General Assembly gets underway in just 3 hours. The budget is in the black. The governor and the legislature have different ideas about what to do with the surplus. We'll parse the big issues facing lawmakers. Tom Pelton puts the environment in focus. Maryland Morning on the mayor's race starts right after these national headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today, we begin a series of conversations with people who have announced their intention to run for mayor of Baltimore. As of today, 9 Democrats, 1 Republican, 1 Green Party candidate, 1 independent, and 3 unaffiliated candidates have registered with the Board of Elections to be on the April 26th ballot. Several candidates who have opened campaign headquarters and who have been actively campaigning have yet to file with the Board of Elections. Their deadline to do so is 3 weeks from today, February 3rd. Each Wednesday for the next several weeks, we'll take some time here on Maryland Morning to speak with candidates about their vision for the city. Today, my guest is Elizabeth Embry. She's a lawyer. She's 38 years old. She lives in Waverly, and she has most recently worked in the Maryland Attorney General's office as the chief of the criminal division. She's a Democrat, and she announced her candidacy on November 6th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you. So why do you want to be the mayor? What about this job is interesting to you?
I love Baltimore, and I'm born and raised here, a daughter of the city. And I've committed myself to the service of the city, primarily as in government. I've worked as a prosecutor. I've worked in housing and labor. I've worked in the trenches of City Hall as a lawyer for different agencies for the city. And I've learned what works and what doesn't. And I know how important a moment this is. And we have to reclaim our streets. We need to be safe. We need to have schools that work for us and jobs and capital in our neighborhoods. And it's the most important election in our lifetime. And it's so important to get it right. So
in terms of how you spend your day, how will you spend your day as mayor, and how will that be more gratifying to you than being in Brian Frosch's office in the Maryland Attorney General's office, for example?
Well, I should say I've been so lucky in my career. I've had terrific jobs, and running the criminal division in the Attorney General's office and working for such a great attorney general like Brian Frosch has been an honor and a lot of fun. We have statewide jurisdiction. We prosecute fraud and corruption cases, from tax fraud to procurement fraud, looking at ways the government is wasting money and ways that our most vulnerable populations are being abused, neglected. We look at the elderly in nursing homes. We prosecute cases against in which the disabled, undocumented immigrants, victims of human trafficking are criminally harmed. We have an environmental crimes unit that's terrific. And we also have an organized crime unit that we created so that we could fight violent crime in the city and across the state. So it's a terrific job, but the city, what the city needs now is so important. And we have to have good management and great leadership that says this city is going to be equal to the city and equal to the efforts of the people in the city. We have so much potential in the city, so many terrific people, programs, institutions, community activists, community efforts, and we need government that is equal to those efforts.
What do you say to folks who say, you know, some experience in the legislative branch of government is important in a job like this? It's a big city. You've been on the legal side, and you've been as a lawyer and working in the judicial side of the equation. But you're starting with mayor. You know, you're not running for city council. You're not taking a lesser office as a sort of warm up. How do you respond to folks who might have concerns in that regard?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One thing is that management experience is critical for this job. And as a city, we do not typically elect people with management experience. We very often, in fact, for the last 50 years, have overwhelmingly elected candidates for mayor with no management experience. with the exception of Kurt Schmoke, who'd run the state's attorney's office. So I think management experience is critical in the...
And you've had that in your position.
I've, as deputy state's attorney, I've supervised over 400 employees, an office of lawyers. Some people say lawyers are the hardest people to manage.
That's herding chickens a lot of times, yeah.
Like herding chickens. Right. I've, of course, run the criminal division, which is a large and important division in the attorney general's office. So I think that's critical, but it's also important to note that I've worked on legislation. I've drafted legislation. I've lobbied for it. I've advised the city council and the mayor's office on legislation. So I've been really in the trenches on the legislative side. So I have that experience as well. And I think that is important to understand how laws are written, how you can write effective laws, and how you can use legislation to advance the efforts of the city.
So we're hearing now why you want to be the mayor. In terms of what the other choices are that people have in this election, and there are plenty of them. There's an awful lot of people running. I mean, it's hard to even keep track. At one point, it was as many as 21 people want this job. The incumbent isn't running. Why should people want you instead of one of the other candidates in this very large field?
Well, we as a city have got to move forward, and we need new leadership, we need new ideas, and we need someone who's able to not just talk the talk, but actually effectuate those policies. And that's what I've done in my career in government as deputy state's attorney, as chief of the criminal division, as a lawyer for the city, and working as director of the mayor's office of criminal justice, working in housing, working at Department of Labor, licensing and regulation. I've done work in all these areas, and I've had the privilege of serving the city in those areas and having real effect in making a change. And we need someone who's able to not just talk about it, but do it. Mm-hmm. And right now, the two critical issues facing the city, there's many, but the two most critical are safety. We have unacceptable levels of violence. We have had 344 murders in 1 year, the highest number on record for a city that's had some pretty horrific years of violence. We have to get that right. We need someone who understands how to reduce violence. And I've done that as deputy state's attorney. I worked on reducing homicide levels to under 200, to the lowest levels in almost 40 years, and violent crime generally. That's really important. We have to get that right. But also
remind
jobs.
People when that was.
I worked in Greg Bernstein. I worked as his deputy, and in 2011 we saw dramatic reductions in homicide across the 4 years. In fact, a year ago we had over 100 fewer homicides than we do this year.
So what's different in your estimation between 2015 and 2011?
Well, one key difference is we have got to focus as a city on figuring out who are the engines of violence, who is committing the crimes. It is a truism that in Baltimore City, as in all cities, the number of violent criminals and the people responsible for violent crime is actually a relatively small number. And that holds true for property crime, for car thefts, for burglaries, for robberies. It's a relatively small number. So you have to work closely in law enforcement to figure out who those people are, build strong cases against them, against organizations of violence, and then build cases that are strong enough to be sustained and to see those through and to have effective cooperation between all levels of law enforcement. And also to focus relentlessly, which we have done in the past and are maybe not doing it successfully now, on gun crimes, on people who are carrying loaded handguns around the streets. And the Commissioner Davis has asked for, and I fully support this, looking at how we are treating gun crime and saying it needs to be a felony. If someone is caught with a loaded gun, illegally carrying a loaded gun on the streets of Baltimore, it needs to be a felony. It needs to be taken seriously, a high priority in our court system, which too often is not the case.
Do you support Commissioner Davis? You've got some opponents in this race who were not willing to sign on to his contract, at least, and they said they'd, you know, have to think about whether or not they would keep Commissioner Davis on in their administration. What are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I've spoken extensively to him, and I've been impressed. He certainly is committed to changing the dynamic between the police department and communities and really working to effectuate that. I'm very interested in watching what he does. I've been impressed so far, and I'm closely watching his work.
Do you see a specific role, a specific thing that the mayor can do to help repair the relationship between the police and the citizens? Because we've had so many instances of police misconduct or alleged police misconduct. What can you do as the mayor to fix that very serious rift?
Absolutely. And having worked as a prosecutor for the bulk of my career, I've seen up close and personal that lack of trust. I've worked very closely. I've mostly prosecuted violent crime cases and worked very closely with victims and witnesses and also with detectives, and have seen in talking with with them and working with them, the layers of distrust and the way that that evolves and the way that it corrodes the effective law enforcement and effective community policing. So it's incredibly important. And it's also important that you understand the system well enough to understand how to make changes. And it goes from how you recruit officers, which we are having a real trouble doing in the city today, to how you train officers, how you involve the community in training, really involve and have training that is focused on the right outcomes.
But the mayor's influence in any of that, what is that exactly?
Well, the police department is within the executive branch, and it's incredibly important. And we spend a lot of money on the police department. It's one of the most critical agencies in the city and one of the most critical areas for the mayor to focus on.
Do you support any specific changes to the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which is now going to be in front of the legislature as the General Assembly begins in about 2 hours and 45 minutes.
And I'm heading down there actually after this.
Uh-huh.
We're looking at all of the different proposals that have come out of the task force and that the chiefs are looking at and supporting. One of the things that I've seen, just one example that is a real problem within the administration of the police department and the way that officers who are committing bad acts are handled, is that there's this enormous delay on the administrative side in resolving cases of police misconduct, which is a waste of taxpayer dollars, is not fair to the victims and the complainants, and does not serve the police department either. And so one of the things that I would absolutely do is have concurrent proceedings, so that if there's a criminal investigation, it doesn't slow down the actions of the police commissioner in taking the necessary steps to take the actions that are needed in that particular case. So that's one example of what needs to be changed procedurally. But we need to have a culture that looks, that is serious about rooting out corruption in the police department and bad practice and bad acts, because there is no one who wants that. No police officer who's doing their job wants to protect or be part of a department that's protecting bad actors. And so we have to be committed to immediately acting and immediately rooting out those problems.
Real quick, we have literally 10 seconds before we take a break for news. Do you support a requirement that city police officers live in Baltimore City?
I wish we could afford to do that. We cannot. We cannot even fill recruiting classes right now. I have an officer who lives across the street from me, and I love it. But no, we need to incentivize it and recruit heavily in the city and do everything we can to draw from the city. But to require that would hamstring us.
Democratic candidate Elizabeth Embry joins me. She's 38 years old and has worked most recently in the office of the Maryland Attorney General as the chief of the criminal division. We've been talking as the program began about the police department and about safety issues affecting the city of Baltimore. Elizabeth, let's pivot now to economic development. You said in your campaign announcement that you wanted to rationalize taxes. What does that mean?
Well, it means we need to be less reliant on property tax revenue in the city, because our property tax rates are out of whack with the rest of the state, both the rates but also the fact that so much of our budget derives from property tax revenue versus, for instance, income tax revenue. And income tax revenue is driven by the prosperity of the city and how much people are earning in the city, which means we need to get more jobs in the city, and we need to get higher paying jobs, and we need to get more people to work. And that's one way to shift the dynamic. But I am committed absolutely to continuing to reduce property taxes so that we're competitive with the surrounding counties, so that people do want to move here and do want to stay.
Right. Yesterday at a press conference with a little preview of what he's got on his mind for the Maryland General Assembly, Governor Hogan had this to say about taxes on manufacturers.
Simply stated, if you're a manufacturer and want to come to Maryland and create jobs where we need them most, we will waive all state taxes for a decade.
Think that's a good idea?
I have just heard about it and looking into it. It's certainly, I like that he is looking at how to get businesses and jobs into the state. I don't know enough about his proposal, the specifics, to comment in detail, but I'm excited that he's focused on getting jobs to Baltimore and to Maryland.
As a general rule, the use of TIFs, these tax incentive financing things that give developers pretty substantial tax breaks to entice them to build buildings. Exelon, the big center that's down there in Harbor East, is one of the most recent ones. What's your opinion about those and their validity and their effectiveness?
Well, a TIF or a pilot are, to me, tools that are useful to a city in promoting growth and bringing jobs into the city. The question, of course, is when you grant them and what the amount is and how you decide that. And so the city needs to be able to look have the right people in place on the city side to evaluate projects and say, this makes sense for the city and this helps us in, you know, these five ways. This gets jobs here. This helps a neighborhood that's trying to develop. This is helps our citizens. And those questions have got to be answered before deciding whether or not the project is appropriate for a TIF or for a pilot. And then what's the right amount? Just because a developer says this is the amount I need doesn't mean that's the correct amount. So we have to have a really strong and robust city government so that we're able to evaluate.
So you sort of take it on a case-by-case basis?
Absolutely. But they're very useful tools where appropriate.
Do you think the city's done a good job in extracting concessions from some of these developers in return for these TIFs and pilots, these tax breaks? In other words, have we demanded enough of the people doing development to help fix some other areas of the city, for example?
I think we could be stronger as a city in both in our evaluation process and in what we demand in exchange for these very, very significant tax breaks. That being said, they are useful tools for spurring development and bringing jobs into the city.
What can the mayor do to spur job creation? I mean, it's, you know, jobs are created by people who run businesses. They're not, generally speaking, unless they're public sector jobs, created by government officials at the city, state, or national level. What can you, as the mayor of Baltimore, do to see that, you know, the unemployment that we have in areas like Sandtown, Winchester, where it's two and three times higher than the unemployment rates in other neighborhoods in our city? What can you do to improve that picture for those folks?
I look at it in two pieces. One piece is bringing jobs into the city, and that means both attracting businesses to the city. It means growing businesses that are in the city, and it means being friendly to startups that don't exist at all yet, and being a city that's the most attractive to startup companies and new companies on the East Coast. And bringing companies here means being a cheerleader for the city, being a salesman and a cheerleader, looking for opportunities, working with the business leaders of the city, and going out and saying to, for instance, businesses in D.C. that are paying three times the rent, why aren't you in Baltimore? Here are all the reasons you should be in Baltimore. You're half an hour away on the train. You don't need to be in D.C. Be in Baltimore. It means making sure that businesses in the city, in our neighborhoods, have access to capital. And again, working with banks, working with the private sector to make sure we have reserves of capital that are available for small and medium-sized businesses to grow. And it also means being attractive to the exciting tech and all of the startup community that is so, the biotech and the arts community, all these communities in Baltimore are really exciting and entrepreneurial. And we need to be open and embrace that spirit and that energy, which we are not doing. We are not remotely taking full advantage of. There are great efforts, but we're not there yet. And the other piece, which is equally important, is removing the obstacles to people in the city getting jobs that already exist or these jobs that we want to attract here. And that means, for one thing, physically, people need to be able to get to jobs. And we have an absolutely antiquated public transit system. And we've just seen research recently reiterated that commute time is one of the key indicators for whether a child and a family will escape poverty, how long it takes for the parents in that family to get to work. And that has to be a top priority, working with the state to reduce those commute times so that someone in Sandtown can get to the jobs that exist, not just within the city, but also in the region. And then also, I'm sorry, the final thing, Tom, is making sure that people don't have impediments to getting the jobs, like a criminal record that could be expunged, or a lack of job skills. So we have to have both an automatic expungement process that allows people to clear their records where legally eligible, and also we have to have an educational system, both high school but also secondary, that truly is aligned with putting people to work, and it really does not exist now.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Elizabeth Embry. She's a Democratic candidate for mayor. The primary election is the 26th of April. You mentioned transportation. So few of the jobs are in places where people can get to easily. There's one study that says, you know, if an average low-skilled worker is making $20,000 a year, sometimes it costs as much as $5,000 to get to and from work. That's a huge percentage of that person's income. The red line has been, you know, with a stroke of a pen from the governor, been canned. What's the next step for the city of Baltimore?
I would say it's a few things. One is we do have to look at long-term infrastructure plans, and the red line may be off the table, but we ultimately will need an east-west connector. That is a necessity for the city. So we have to be focused as a city on what that looks like and how we make that long-term strategy to get there. But also in the short term, we have to improve our bus system. It is what the majority of citizens of the city rely on, and it needs to be better.
And improving means what then? Doing exactly what to it?
Well, it means specifically reducing the commute time for people across the city and making sure we have the most efficient system that we have. We have right now antiquated technology. We have these radio signals that tell people when the bus is coming. We need GPS on all the buses so that people reliably can say, when will the bus arrive? And we need accountability within the MTA so that buses are arriving when they're scheduled to arrive. And there's management and oversight of that. So I'm looking very closely at the governor's proposed rerouting of the bus system to make sure it does accomplish those things, that it gets people to work faster, that it is more accountable so that the buses come when they say they're going to come, and you know because you have an app on your phone or you have a sign on the bus stop that says they will be here at this time, and that's true, which is not currently the case.
But the initial reaction on the part of a lot of folks to the governor's bus revamping plan is that it's really not a serious proposal, that he's not really addressing the heart of the issue, and that this is kind of window dressing to try to appease people who are so deeply disappointed about the absence of the red line.
It is no substitute for the red line. It is no substitute for a connector, east-west connector. Absolutely not. And we have got to have that for the city to thrive and be a modern city with a modern transit system.
Do you know the governor?
I've served on the governor's heroin and opioid task force, which was very interesting. And it was a task force that went across the state and looked at problems that the city's been facing for decades, the impact of opioid and heroin abuse on communities and the overdose deaths that result. And it meant listening to tragic stories across the state and what other jurisdictions are doing. But it also reminded me that we have in Baltimore a pretty robust public health system, and we're doing a lot of things right in drug treatment and overdose prevention. We can do more, but we're getting a lot right. And that was exciting to see, because Baltimore has a long history of really effective public health leadership.
There's been folks, at least in the media, who have surmised that the relationship between the current mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, and Governor Hogan is not good. It certainly didn't seem to be particularly terrific at the time of the uprising in April. Do you speculate that your relationship with him would be better than that he seems to have with the current mayor?
Well, without commenting on the current relationship, I don't have any personal knowledge of it. I've certainly spent my career working very closely with the state administrations, and I've worked with this current administration as well. I'm very good at finding common ground, at figuring out how we can all move forward together. As Baltimore goes, Maryland goes. So Baltimore is absolutely critical to Maryland, and I'm sure the governor is, I'm sure, aware of that.
The NAACP has filed a lawsuit against Governor Hogan because of his dismissal of the red line. What should the city's posture be in that lawsuit?
I'm watching it very closely. I'm very curious. It's a novel legal theory and very interesting, and something that I'm watching very closely.
Education. Dr. Thornton has been subject of a lot of criticism for kind of a vision deficit, people describe it as. They don't see him as nearly as dynamic as his predecessor, for example, Dr. Andres Alonso. What's your opinion of Dr. Thornton and how the city schools are currently being run?
There are some significant challenges in North Avenue. And my sister is a public school teacher. She teaches at Tunbridge Academy, which is a public charter, and she's taught it at traditional public schools throughout her career. So I talk a lot to her, and I've been going out and talking to principals and teachers across the city. My mother has also spent her career, she's a public artist, a sculptor, a welder, but also has devoted herself to making sure that students in public schools have access to high-quality arts education, like their counterparts in private schools. So I've spent my lifetime in the public school system. I graduated from City College and thinking about and talking to people who work in it currently. So I will say as a general principle that North Avenue is too often an impediment and not a supporter of what works in schools. And we have great practices in schools across the city. City College is one. I have to give a shout out to a city school that is in the top 4% of public high schools nationally, but there are numerous other examples, and we need to have a school system in North Avenue that is supporting the replication of best practices and giving appropriate autonomy to schools to make sure that they are able to do what they need to do to make sure that the classroom teaching is the most effective it can be. And that means giving increased autonomy, something that Alonzo was very passionate about. And it means attracting the best human capital to the school system and making sure that teachers and principals who are here feel supported and want to stay, because human capital is the core of the success of the school
system. Is Gregory Thornton the best person to affect that?
I'm looking forward to talking to him. I've been talking to people throughout the school system to evaluate what the right leadership should be.
Mm-hmm. One of your opponents, Carl Stokes, has made a big sort of centerpiece of his campaign the fact that the city rarely audits various departments. What are your feelings about audits, the need for them, and how they should be carried out, who should do them, et cetera?
I am a huge fan of audits. I have had the pleasure at the state level as chief of the criminal division of the attorney general's office of working with state auditors who do a very good job. Usually they're bringing cases to us that are criminal. They've uncovered actual fraud and theft from state coffers. But I've also seen their work in the context of helping agencies do better and helping agencies spend money better and have practices in place that protect public dollars and improve efficiency. So I'm a huge fan of audits. I think when done correctly, they help agencies do their job and are not hostile, but they can also uncover some really bad practices. So they're critical. I'm fully supportive of audits. In terms of who should do them, I would like to have a city auditing function that's strong enough, but I have no problem relying on outside auditors to get the job done if necessary.
Well, Elizabeth Embry, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much. We are out of time, and we will certainly stay tuned as the campaign continues.
Tom, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Elizabeth Embry is a Democratic candidate for mayor. We'll continue our conversations with all the mayoral candidates and people seeking other offices next Wednesday and every Wednesday leading up to the April 26th primary election. Next week, my guest will be former Mayor Sheila Dixon. If you're not registered to vote, you have until April 5th to register to be able to participate in this important election. We've got a link to the website with registration information at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. If you know people who aren't registered, please come to our website and send them the link.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. The 2016 session of the Maryland Assembly kicks off today at noon, with Governor Larry Hogan enjoying strong approval ratings. He carries a mandate into this year's session that Democratic legislators may find hard to overcome when they lock horns on issues like tax cuts, education funding, and criminal justice reform. So let's take a few minutes to touch on some of the issues that lawmakers will consider between now and April. Joining me on the phone from Annapolis is Erin Cox. She is the State House Bureau Chief for the Baltimore Sun. Morning, Erin.
Good morning.
So the tone of this year's session, even in these preliminary days and now hours before it begins, seems to be remarkably different. And you and Mike Dresser wrote about this in Sunday's paper and as well as this morning's. The tone seems to be different than last year.
Right. There's kind of a talking out of both sides of their mouth this year, when last year they just talked about bipartisanship. This year they talk about bipartisanship and then with their next breath criticize the other party for what they value and what they want to do.
There's certainly going to be plenty to talk about. You speculate that there's as many as 1,200 separate bills that may be considered. How does anybody, any legislature, deal with that much legislation?
Well, you know, actually, those 1,200 bills are the ones that are currently being drafted. There's usually around 3,400. This is 1,200 before the bells even ring, before the gavel even drops, before we start. So that 1,200 bills is a pace that's much faster than we've seen in a long time. So it'll be busy. Some of them may not be big initiatives. Like in past years, we've, you know, legalized same-sex marriage down here, passed sweeping gun control sort of initiatives that take a lot of muscle to get through. Whether or not the volume of bills are going to be of that caliber doesn't really seem to be the case. So we'll see. We got a lot of new lawmakers. There was a third of the House was new, a quarter of the Senate was new last year. This year they've got a year under their belt and they're ready to push their own initiatives, and we'll see how that goes.
There's speculation, and it's been fueled by the leadership of the House and Senate, that the legislature is poised to overturn some, if not all, of the vetoes that Governor Hogan signed last year, having to do with issues like felons being able to vote sooner than they are currently able to vote upon release from prison, or a piece of legislation about possession of marijuana paraphernalia, that kind of thing. What do you think the chances of these overrides going through are?
Well, the chances of at least one going through, I would say, are all but certain. That not all of all most of these measures were passed by veto-proof margins or very close to last year when the legislature approved them. Some of them are you know, still a little bit iffy. Voting for felons are among them. It's not clear that there's enough votes to push that one through. That's something that, as your newscaster mentioned earlier, the Baltimore City Council endorsed earlier this week. It would allow felons to retain their voting rights before they finish probation or parole. That one is a little bit iffy, as is the marijuana one. The legislature decriminalized pot about 2 years ago, but they left all the paraphernalia to smoke it a crime to possess. So they tried to reverse that, and they went a little bit further and made it legal to smoke in public, and the law enforcement community really disliked that. So they've been pushing hard to keep the veto intact.
You were at the press conference that the governor held yesterday when he outlined his tax proposals. One of them is to grant a 10-year tax break to new companies who locate manufacturing in Baltimore and some other districts in the state, Western Maryland and the Lower Eastern Shore. You write this morning in a blog post that this idea actually comes from a very similar proposal by Richard Maddalena, who's the vice chair of the Budget and Tax Committee, Montgomery County Democrat. That would indicate that perhaps there's going to be some agreement on the nature of this kind of proposal. What chances do you give that kind of thing?
Well, you know, the devil's in the details, of course. I mean, the broad strokes of this plan is something that Hogan modeled off New York's Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo, and it was actually Senator Roger Mano, who is also a very liberal senator from Montgomery County, who happened to pushed that one. And, you know, it didn't get through the legislature when a Democrat pushed it. That doesn't necessarily mean it would get through the legislature when a Republican pushed it. So I think there's people that want to wait and see. I think it gives it much better chances than if Hogan had just proposed it on his own. But we also don't know how he plans to pay for it and what he plans to give the Democrats in exchange for passing it.
Mr. Maddalena was also talking about an earned income tax credit. That's something that perhaps there might be some agreement on as well. What do you think the chances of something like that happening in this session are?
Extremely high. The earned income tax credit is something that's, almost like a pet policy to the Democrats. They really like it. It gives cash to poor families. Widely seen as an alternative to families being on welfare. And what happens is when you give, you know, families, poor families, an extra couple hundred dollars, they tend to spend it. They get their car fixed. They buy clothes for their kids. They buy groceries. And so they find it to be a very effective way to stimulate the economy and to get tax dollars right back into the economy, which is something that Governor Hogan says that he really wants to do. And he said yesterday, and he's said several times before, he put the number at 100. I'm not sure it's quite that high. But he said that he doesn't really care which side of the aisle the ideas come from. He just wants to do things that make sense. And the earned income tax credit is something that Democrats really love. It seems like the debate down here isn't whether or not they implement an increase to it. It's whether or not they implement an increase and they expand it and they make the increase even bigger than what the governor proposed.
There are lots of arguments about the funding formula for education. We are in a situation here in the state where there is a surplus. The Democrats certainly want to spend it in a much different way than Mr. Hogan does. Where do things stand, particularly in terms of the two separate approaches to education funding?
Well, the Democrats want to make sure that education is fully funded every single year, regardless of whether there's a surplus or a deficit. They want to make sure that every dollar that they say should go to education does go to education. And if there's cuts that have to be made, they want to be the ones that are in control of it. Governor Larry Hogan has said, you know what, I don't think that's a good plan. Well, I'll fully fund it this year, but if we ever run into economic trouble again, I don't think it should be up to the legislature to decide whether or not education gets funded. It should be up to the governor. And so you've got this power clash that's a lot more, it's more about power than education funding. It just happens to be education funding that they're talking about.
In health care, the right to die legislation is being reintroduced. What kind of this is allowing terminally ill patients to have a physician assist them in their suicide. What do you give the chances of that one?
Better than last year, but not 100%. Controversial issues like that generally take 2-3 years to get through the legislature. Last year, they pulled it before it even came to a committee vote because they knew that it was unlikely to pass. Then they formed a work group over the summer, and they tried to educate a lot more people about the issue, and the advocates plan to come back again and try again. Whether or not they actually get there is unclear this year. Public support for this issue has been trending towards the advocates for many years, particularly after Brittany Maynard. She was the 29-year-old woman who had brain cancer and moved to Oregon in order to take her own life and was very public about that.
All right, and Aaron, we're going to have to call it a day. I appreciate your time. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you, so thanks so much for stopping by this morning. Appreciate it.
Of course.
Aaron Cox is the State House Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. WYPR's Rachel Bay will be in Annapolis and keeping us up to date on all of the goings-on in this, the 436th session of the Maryland Assembly, which begins today at noon. You've been listening to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.